You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Diplomacy means talking to everyone, but leadership means not letting the other guy tell you what to do in your own house. David Cameron needs to show that he's got what it takes to stand up to oppressive leaders.
President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi of Egypt visits 10 Downing Street to a somewhat equivocal welcome. Is he really the sort of company the leaders of democracies should be keeping? My guests Michael Binion and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Flight 9268. Egypt insists it was a mechanical failure. Russia says it's too soon to tell. But the UK seems to have decided that it was a bomb. How certain can we be that we'll ever really know? And still they come. October's influx of migrants into Germany was yet another record breaker. How much strain is Angela Merkel's coalition under? And also...
My own personal theory is that Joseph built the pyramids in order to store grain.
This man is actually still running to be president of the United States of America. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both to the programme. We will start today here in London, specifically at number 10 Downing Street, whose inhabitants had probably been hoping that the major international news story of the week would attract attention away from Egypt rather than towards it. The Prime Minister's residence has today been hosting Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, not widely regarded as a dauntless champion of democracy and human rights. Michael, when creatures like al-Sisi hove into view, one is always put in mind of that quote, usually attributed to FDR about Somoza, that he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Is al-Sisi getting a pass under that rule?
Yes, he is. Well, first of all, he's getting a pass under several rules. That one, because he is essentially...
Lyndon Johnson's one about the tent and
well,
J. Edgar Hoover's.
pissing and
leaps to mind.
Yeah. He is determinedly ready to continue existing security arrangements in the Middle East. In other words, he will uphold the treaty with Israel, which is important to the Western alliance generally. He's a man who is deeply concerned in fighting Islamist extremism. One might say overdoing it, but he is fighting it, and that's also a Western goal. He is a person who will guarantee stability, and that's important for investors and for the predictability of Egypt. He ticks a lot of boxes. He also ticks quite a number of other boxes that we don't like very much, but I think we are ready to turn a blind eye to some of those.
Sebastian, that quality Michael raises there of predictability, which is a rare and valuable commodity in the Middle East. If we are being just basically, you could say pragmatic / cynical, it's a very fine line, but in al-Sisi's defence, and I don't use the phrase lightly, you could argue that Egypt, aside maybe from Jordan, is pretty much the only friendly, coherent Arab state still remaining between Tunisia and the Gulf. That being the case, is it better just to deal with the guy?
Can I just say, apart from what we in the West think about him, I think the watchword is stability. Ever since the French Revolution, we talk about democracy and human rights and all that. But the first thing people want is stability. And I think if you talk to Egyptians, and there are plenty who would like a member of the Muslim Brotherhood in power, but I think there are actually a few more who aren't terribly keen on that. What he brought to the country was stability for the people there, whatever we think of him. And if to answer your question, absolutely. I mean, I don't think we have any choice in the matter but to talk to people. You know, the Chinese dictator, you know, call him a president, whatever you like. It's not even approaching anything.
Al-Sisi, in his defense, at least when measured against China, bothers to pretend to hold elections every so often.
There we are. And Britain welcomed the Chinese president. I think that the point is, the tone that you use, and I thought the towards China there is a great danger of kowtowing from not just Britain but from a lot of European countries, and again with Sisi you've got to deal with the guy who's there and obviously mention and mention very forcefully the concerns you have, but in the end you can't get away from him, from Egypt, from us wanting Egypt to be a stability factor in the region.
Michael, the point Sebastian raises there is one often advanced by people trying to defend the dealing of democracies with dictators, that in terms of things like human rights, they're more likely to listen to friends having a quiet word rather than people, you know, waving their arms and yelling at them. Is there anything to that, or is that a somewhat self-serving defence?
No, I think it's a very wise motto, and it's probably the essence of old-fashioned diplomacy. It was a former British Foreign Secretary, Lord Carrington, who decried and renounced the idea of megaphone diplomacy, saying it doesn't work. You bellow through a megaphone, you might sound good on your own stage, but the noise coming to the other party is simply insults. And if you invite someone to your country, you don't insult them. You deal with them firmly, clearly, and you make your position clear. You can't choose the people you deal with. As somebody said, you negotiate with your enemies, not with your friends. You deal with your enemies. Sisi is in no way an enemy. We have concerns about him, certainly. But he's there. He's a person ready to listen to us. He's ready to listen as long as we don't make him lose face while he's with us, and that would be extremely foolish.
But this is the circular argument which I guess has been revolving roughly since September 12, 2001, that one of the justifications for militant Islamism is exactly this, that the West continues to support dictators because the West would rather have a stable Middle East than a peaceful Middle East. Are we just seeing the cycle go round again, Sebastian?
I doubt very much that the people who were behind the atrocities of 9/11 and every other Islamist murder after that have anything other in mind than a dictatorship of their own. In fact, I suppose if you had to rate dictatorships, you wouldn't. You'd rather live under President's general dictator Sisi in Egypt than under the Taliban in Afghanistan, who after all harbored bin Laden and all these other unpleasant people. The argument is true that we are dealing with countries who do not match our ideas of human rights, of equality before the law. There is terrible corruption, there's no doubt about it. The problem is the world is the way it is. You know, we can't... let's try to deal with the problems we have in a sensible and manner which adheres to our values, and don't lecture to other people.
Well, we're going to move along very slightly from this story because an unwelcome entry at the top of Cameron and al-Sisi's agenda will have been Saturday's crash of a Russian-operated airliner in the Sinai shortly after leaving the popular resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Yesterday, British officials grounded all flights between the UK and Sharm el-Sheikh pending an inspection of the airport by British aviation security experts, leaving little doubt of British suspicions that the plane was brought down by a bomb. Michael, how tricky a conversation will this have been for David Cameron? Because this is basically Britain saying to Egypt, one, we don't believe you about the reasons for the plane crash, and two, we don't trust you to secure your airports.
Well, it's quite difficult because FACE is involved, and also the vital industry of tourism will be enormously affected straight away. Sharm el-Sheikh is one of the few places where tourists are still going in some large numbers. It's an extremely important earner of foreign currency. And if there are questions over that resort, there are also questions over the other ones on the Red Sea. And overnight, one of Egypt's greatest industries is ruined. But on the other hand, Cameron has a duty to protect British lives. If he believes, and he obviously believes this from intelligence sources, probably from monitoring of conversations either by British intelligence or American or both.
Or Saudi.
Or Saudi, or whoever it is, that there are clear indications that there was a conspiracy and a bomb was planted. And after all, Britain has experience of this. We had the Lockerbie bomb. And in fact, Britain did an amazing job, British investigators and others, in identifying the fragments of that aeroplane and proving it was a bomb, which could still be done in Sinai. I think it's still perfectly possible to work out whether it really was a bomb. But there is a duty to take action about that. Now, Egypt hasn't categorically denied it's a bomb. All Egypt has said is, we don't know what brought it down, and there were no missile attacks.
I think Egypt is very much just desperately hoping it wasn't a bomb.
Well, of course, because the implication is, if it was a bomb, it was planted in the luggage in Sharm el-Sheikh Airport, which suggests Sharm el-Sheikh Airport has lousy security. And I've been through that airport five times, or six, actually, because I've come back, and the security is not that good.
Sebastian, what have you made of the political bickering that has developed over this in the last 24 hours? Because Russia's now complaining that the British aren't telling them anything. Frankly, it'd be more surprising.
The sheer cheek of these people, marvellous.
It would be more surprising if the British were telling the Russians anything. Egypt are complaining that it's all terribly premature. Is it possible that the truth about this flight could actually get buried by political wrangling?
I was very interested, Michael, mentioning the example of Lockerbie. I mean, that was really a lecture book kind of investigation of an attack like that. And there must be people there on the ground, and there are people from France, from Germany, from Ireland, who will piece it together, and who I think the truth will come out. I can't quite believe that the Egyptians would be able to brush it under the carpet. I'm not an aviation expert, but people talk about the safety record of this plane. People talk about that the airline has said, we've checked the other four, three out of the other four remaining A321s that we have. Three of them are in perfect nick. We're checking up on the fourth. Let's just say the likelihood, and that's all that Cameron has said, the likelihood is very much veering towards a bomb. Now, but the interesting thing, of course, is the bomb was put on the plane on Saturday. But the fact that the Brits now say we can't have flights from and to Sharm el-Sheikh suggests that they've been on the ground and that the security is still lousy. And I have to say, if I was a tourist, German, Dutch, British, whatever tourist, planning to go there, have my golfing holidays or whatever you did there, Michael, in Sharm el-Sheikh.
I don't know. The beach.
Well, exactly. I'd really quite like to know that my government took care to take all necessary measures, and if that has a detrimental effect on an industry which is under pressure anyway, because the plane, after all, did come down. So be it,
Michael. If it was, or if it turns out that it was a bomb and that it was planted there by Islamic State, as Islamic State keep claiming they did, or at least Sinai Province, the local franchise thereof, what impact might that have on Russian public opinion about Russia's involvement in Syria? Because this would be framed by Islamic State as straightforward revenge for Russia's involvement in Syria, which so far has been fairly popular among Russians.
Yes, well, it would simply fortify Putin's position enormously, and it would actually...
There wouldn't be any sense of... Because we see this happen in the West time and time again, when Western interests are targeted by Islamist terrorists, there is a large faction saying, we brought it on ourselves, it's all our fault, really. That's not going to be the case in Russia.
I don't think that's a Russian reaction.
The Jeremy Corbyn school of thought.
Well, we've had similar things happen in Russia itself.
We've had
Chechen widows, as they're called, the Black Widows, put bombs or target suicide vests on planes and brought down Russian planes inside Russia. And that didn't mean that Putin or anyone let up on the fight in Chechnya. Far from it. Redoubled the fight. The feeling you cannot make concessions to terrorists, you will redouble your fight. That's very strong, not only in Putin, but in public opinion generally. And in fact, actually, this would work to Putin's advantage in his relations with the West, because he would say, we're on your side in fighting ISIS. We suffer too. We understand this. Russia's strategic aims in Syria would actually be bolstered if this was the case.
Sebastian, to loop this conversation back to our first item, the one thing that can be said is that at least in the short term, Egypt's tourist industry will be enormously damaged, which will be enormously damaging for Egypt's economy. Now, the reason, as we've decided, for dealing with somebody like al-Sisi is that he represents and guarantees stability. Can he actually do that if Egypt's economy starts disintegrating underneath him?
It gets ever more difficult. But look, I mean, it's not rocket science. You sort out security of an airport. I mean, it can't be that difficult. You help them, by all means. Send American, British, whoever specialists there. Sort out the security. And then I think if I were the Prime Minister, I would actually say, look, guys, we've sorted it out. Go and have your holidays in the sun again. By all means. That's what we did with Tunisia after the attack there in the spring. We I think people actually said it's as safe as it can ever be. And please go there and support a country, in Tunisia's case, of course, the only democracy which has come out of the so-called Arab Spring.
Well, to some extent in Egypt, it is rocket science, because what you don't want to have is terrorists running around in Sinai with rockets. And that was the original accusation, that they had a missile to shoot down the airplane. Now, that seems to be impossible, but nevertheless, Western airlines still have taken the precaution of not flying over Sinai, just in case they have rockets there.
Okay, well, we are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Michael Binion and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, Mike, might German Chancellor Angela Merkel be beginning to regret her country's generosity towards migrants?
The Big Interview is back, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the worlds of art and culture, business and design, returns for a new season here on Monocle 24.
Nobody wants a star to be different. They want them to be the same all the time. That's anathema to me. I've always wanted to be different. I would look different, sound different, think differently, walk differently. And I still want that.
This week, British theatre actor turned Hollywood icon Ian McKellen in conversation with Robert Bound.
I could talk about it and wanted to on behalf of other people who weren't as lucky as I was. And I've gone on doing that. So I've found the best part I've ever played, really, which is being an openly gay man.
The Big Interview with Ian McKellen premieres Sunday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
And you are welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion. And let's look now at Germany, because back in the summer, Germany's response to the endless columns of migrants traipsing across Eastern Europe was widely praised as an example of big-hearted generosity on a continent largely responding with indifference or hostility. However, Germany's people and politicians are now discovering that absorbing hundreds of thousands of bewildered people who don't speak the language is rather easier said than done. And the practicalities are prompting splits amid the ruling coalition of Chancellor Angela Merkel. Sebastian, first of all, along what lines are these splits and how serious are they?
They're serious. Unfortunately, of course, the region of Germany which is absorbing the most refugees is Bavaria. Now, Bavaria has traditionally had its own version of the Conservative Party, slightly more conservative than in the rest of the country, and always concerned to put the particular Bavarian slant on politics. So that gives the Bavarian Premier Seehofer a particular role in German politics. The Social Democrats are interestingly keeping very quiet for the time being and sort of waiting for the Conservatives, Merkel and Seehofer, to work out a compromise between themselves.
Michael, was this always likely to happen? That it seems a crass phrase to use in the circumstances, that the novelty has worn off and now everyone is rather faced with the reality of what they've taken on.
I'm afraid it was always going to happen. People said so. It's no reason to say we're not taking in refugees. I mean, I think Angela Merkel's big-hearted gesture at the start of this whole crisis was enormously important for Germany's global reputation and for the sense that this is a country with a moral vision of politics. The problem is the working out of it means that it's very costly. It will actually then start to irritate a great many small communities. And the other problem is it sets an example that, of course, is repeated again and again. So more come. When you do that with one group, then more come. And then they, too, find that they're trekking through the mud in winter. And the big-hearted response is, should we take them in or not? And it seems to be, you know, an endless cycle of people coming.
Sebastian, it is exactly that. October was a record-breaking month, 181,000 more in October alone. So during the summer, when I think Germany attracted applause for announcing that it would take 800,000 people this year, that number is going to be comfortably exceeded. There is no end at all in sight. As Michael points out, winter is coming, and assuming that the news organisations have not completely lost interest by then, the footage of that is going to be fairly tough to look at. Do you have any sense, as a German, where the limit of Germany's capacity and Germany's, tolerance for this is going to lie?
Compare and contrast with Britain, who has who has promised to take 20,000 people over the next 5 years.
Compare and contrast with my native Australia, which I think indeed has grudgingly agreed to take in an extra 12,000.
Indeed, yes.
I think I'm right in saying Germany is about half the size of New South Wales and already has 80 million people living in it.
Look, I mean, it's not, I don't think, strictly speaking, a question of numbers. It is a question of, is politics in control of the country? In other words, in control of the borders and in control of the people who live within the country. And I think Merkel has come dangerously close to suggesting that she isn't. Now, if she is, and I think she's rowing back from that, she's in her usual calm way trying to position herself between the hardliners, the Bavarian hardliners of her own conservative bloc and the rather softer social democrats. But I think she has to get on with it. And I think the mistake was, it was a great gesture, morally right, all that. The mistake was to, at the same time, say, we shall take them, but we will have to look who it is who's coming, and we will have to send quite a few back.
We've talked about this before, though. Yes. How prepared, given its history, is Germany prepared to do that?
Well, Germany has done that before. I mean, we had a very liberal paragraph in our constitution about asylum, which obviously came out of the experience of the Nazi era and the gratefulness for nations like Britain and America in taking in refugees from Germany. But we had to revise that in the early 90s already, because there was this tremendous influx of people back then from the former Yugoslavia. Interestingly, of course, a lot of those people who came in then have actually gone back as soon as their own countries, country of Yugoslavia, now different countries, have stabilized to a degree where they feel they can build their own existence. So I think the other thing that Merkel hasn't done and needs to do more, and Germany need to fulfill its role on the world stage, and we've got to work much harder towards a solution of the Syrian civil war.
Okay, well, finally tonight, by way of light relief, we shall take a dip into the ceaselessly self-replenishing cornucopia of nonsense that is the Republican Party's presidential contest. It is usually to be expected that any such race will attract its share of obviously unelectable yahoos. What is so far making this race interesting and or terrifying is that the comedy candidates persist in leading it. Latest polls have Donald Trump still in front, just ahead of Ben Carson. Now, it's the latter we want to talk about because he has this week confirmed his somewhat unorthodox take on Egyptology, insisting that the pyramids are not, as is commonly believed, mausoleums built by the pharaohs, but grain stores erected by Old Testament patriarch Joseph. Michael, I cannot think of a polite way to ask the question. Why has this clown not been laughed off stage yet?
Well, because lots of people believe all sorts of very strange things in America, and there's a sort of open freedom of crackpot beliefs. There are plenty of other people who believe many more impossible things. I mean, look how many people seriously wondered whether the moonshots were all simply hoaxes or had been framed, or people who still believe the moon is not made of rock, but, you know, green cheese, or, well, maybe not, but, you know, really outlandish theories. And politicians are just as given to this. I mean, we've seen other politicians in other countries come up with absolutely mad ideas.
I don't know, this is pretty special. I mean,
well, how about
this would be pretty career-ending
It would be 3,000 years out of date. I mean, Joseph, if we're talking about the husband of Mary, we're talking about 2,000 years ago.
No, it's not that one.
It's the New Testament, Joseph.
Yeah, it's the Old Testament patriarch.
Okay. Well, we're still
Father of technicolor coat wearing.
Ah, yes.
Actually, no, was that Joe? His father was Jacob. I've lost track
He was the youngest who was sent away by his brothers, who wanted him dead, basically. And then the brothers.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is the Technicolor dream coat wearing Joseph. I lose track of who beget who.
It doesn't really matter because nobody would be quite sufficiently interested in the actual correct scientific detail. Just as the United Nations wasn't particularly interested, it was simply bemused when a former Prime Minister of Grenada, Eric Gehry, seriously suggested in a speech to the UN that the UN should set up an organization to investigate unidentified flying objects, which he thought was the key challenge to today's world.
But this is the Prime Minister of Grenada, which, with all due respect to the people of that great nation, is not one of the world's more significant powers. This guy wants to be President of the United States. Sebastian, I'd be interested in your thoughts. I can never figure out at moments like this which is more frightening, that he believes this nonsense or he doesn't.
We look forward to having him in the White House with his finger on the trigger, don't we? To be honest, this guy's a neurosurgeon by training.
Well, this is the thing. He's clearly in that field a brilliant man.
A brilliant man, clearly. No, you know, there is all sorts of wacky religious beliefs. I'm one of those people who has great faith in the great American nation. I just think sooner or later Mr. Carson will end up on the scrap heap of political history where he belongs.
But you have to say, take another American president, widely acclaimed as one of the most wise, far-sighted and all that, Ronald Reagan. What did his wife guide their lives by?
Well,
by consulting astrologers.
But you can't start with wives, because then we'd have to talk about Sherry Blair and her beliefs in all sorts of, what do you call it? Alternative therapies.
Alternative is the polite way of describing them. There are several less polite ways of describing them. I mean, I speak myself, Sebastian, like you, a huge Americaphile, if that is indeed the word. I try to have faith in it as a great democracy. Final thought from each of you then, very, very briefly. Do you think there is actually a chance, I'll ask you first, Michael, that either Trump or Carson will be the Republican nominee for president?
No, I don't. I think in the end it'll come down to Rubio or somebody who's a pretty solid political record.
Sebastian, do you think the grown-ups will win through in the end?
Absolutely, yes.
Well, here's hoping. Surely all three of us can't be wrong. Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion, thank you both as ever for joining us on Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Clara Strunk. For the next half hour, Matt Alagaya will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Andrew Tuck follows him at 1900 with The Urbanist, at 2200 The Monocle Daily with me, and I think I'm right in saying Emma Nelson. I'm also back with Midori House the same time tomorrow, 1800 London, but for this edition, It's goodbye. Thanks for listening.